This is Maya, who you've been emailing. Did you meet
him?
Hi,
I haven't met him because I've been so busy. I apologize.
shall I introduce?
Can I, like, set up for a second? Just need to turn on the I'm very disorganized and ill, so I apologize if I cough and sniffle. That won't make a beautiful Hollywood shot, but I'll do what I can.
Can you leave the door open a crack in case somebody comes in? Things started to go usually 5 minutes after. I don't want to lock the door. Is that okay? Just keep an eye on the door. Can we leave it open a little bit?
Sorry?
Can we leave the door open a little
bit? Yeah, that's fine.
Because there isn't, it's very quiet in here. This is much better than the last
one. Yeah, should we get your race?
No, I won't be touching upon those 3 points this afternoon. No, please. I'm just waiting for the technology to kick in. Pardon? Yes, I was. I think I sat next to you all the time, actually, in that way. Memory. Yes. I probably should have done this beforehand, but... So how's it going, guys? Midterms? Over? No? Was it reading week last week? It was reading week? Well.
I'll send you the extra test book. I thought I lost that French copy, but I found it here in the
meeting. Did you guys all access the test?
Okay.
Did you all access those? Did you say access those? Sorry? Well, we've been telling some of the history and memory talks, and you can access them and them if you want. Philip, explain where they are.
Oh, yeah, just me and you.
No, it's fine.
What's that called officially?
A cool TV. No. Be cool TV.
Be cool TV.
Be cool.
Yeah.
What is it called? The McGill University Film Archives? Or?
Well, this is just our webcast and stuff. It's on the web. All high quality stuff is on it.
High quality.
No, it's,
I mean, this is compressed for the web, so it's a bit less than all that when you get on the
web. So you can look at the lectures that we've done in the past.
Everybody else's lectures.
Yeah. So it's item number 11. Well, yeah. Well, I'd like to. Are you ready, sir?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone back again to our History and Memory series. And I'd particularly like to warmly welcome Maya, who was a student of history and memory here at McGill. I particularly remember her paper on Iran Nemirovsky, which was memorable, and I learned a great deal from it. And one of the reasons I invited Maya to come back again, now that she's been doing extra reading on history and memory, and she intends to go on to Cambridge University and do an MPhil in this general area, to say a word about the history of autobiography and history of memory. She's thought a lot about it. She's done really important and interesting work in this field. I was going to introduce her by saying a word about her past life and childhood, but she said she would prefer to do it herself. And so I'll let Maya introduce it herself, because I do really believe, from knowing her now for years, I remember when she came to McGill a few years ago, and I remember her dad when her dad studied at McGill, that her personal experience has played an important part in her interest in memory, I think it's safe to say, and she could perhaps say a word about that. So Maya,
thank
you so much for coming.
Thanks. Okay, so it's actually really nice to be back at McGill, and it's kind of funny that I should be here to talk about nostalgia and be nostalgic for my time with, you know, the history department. So it's been great. Thank you, Professor Hellman. And also, it's actually, like he said, I'm going to graduate school next year. It's been nice to prepare because, like he said, I will be continuing with history, nostalgia, and memory for my graduate degree. So this is, I will get to my personal background, but this is how I've sort of outlined my talk. What I'm going to go through first is the concepts and language of nostalgia as outlined in those readings that I gave Professor Hellman to give to you, Boehm and Fichte. And then I'll talk to you about my own personal engagement with nostalgia and what interests me now about studying nostalgia in particular as I moved into graduate school. I'll be looking at nostalgia's role in the creative impulse in both modern art theory and modern political theory. So looking at things like nostalgia's role to the quest for purity, pureness of form, the ideal, beauty, absolutes, and how they intersect in aesthetic and political theory in the 20th century. So that's how the talk is going to go. So in my readings, I find Boehm to be more comprehensive and more important, I think, than Fichte in terms of being really comprehensive in terms of the Western tradition. But I still think, nonetheless, that Fichte does bring some really important points to the table that I'm going to go over first before moving on to Boehm, especially in relation to autobiography and the modern sense of self. I think the biggest point that he brings home is the importance of the French Revolution, and while sometimes his periodization is a little bit shaky, I think that the fact that he brings up that after the French Revolution there was an outpouring of autobiography and writing about memory, so much so that it was only sort of outdone by the autobiographical writing after 1945, I think that's really a huge point to bring up. And he also talks about how in the 19th century there's this explosion of in the middle class of sort of preserving quotidien life, like preserving the mundane, everything from writing in diaries to scrapbooking to taking family photographs to preserving little trinkets. And I think that's a really important thing that starts in the aftermath of the French Revolution and by and large is continued up until, you know, through the 20th century. My great-grandmother was born in 1876, and her home of birth is still preserved, very much like a museum. And when I went in there as a child, I remembered all of these little trinkets, part of like that grandma impulse that I'm sure that you can see in your own family, lots of preservations of little sort of worthless things. And Fichte talks about that, and I think that that's a really important point that he brings up. Also, really, really crucial is the fact that, yes, there have been other junctions in history, as I think a few of you called them in your questions and pointers. But I think that Fichte is right in emphasizing how huge the French Revolution was and how huge the Napoleonic Wars were and how they really did stretch across Europe, affecting so many people across really a generation of time. And not only... just one class of people, it really was across social strata. And I think that's really, really important because you have everyone from the kings, the aristocracy, you know, all the way down to the peasants that are actually being palpably affected by historical change. And it's really quite radical. You can't underestimate, what the Republicans of the French Revolution envisioned, a complete denial of a national past and reinventing everything from, you know, a new calendar, a new clock, a new citizen, essentially a whole new sort of world order. Other points that he brings up that I think are key, and Boehm talks about this also, is sort of this intersection between the private and the public. Sort of the disconnect between the personal narrative and the public narrative and how important it is in the aftermath of the French Revolution, all of a sudden there's this awakening of the I in the sweep of history. So because it touched so many people, you have so many individuals that suddenly feel like they're part of this giant movement. Whether or not they're participating or if they're for or if they're against, they understand that something big is changing. And I think, he talks about Chateaubriand's memoirs a lot. And I don't know if, did you read Chateaubriand in this class? No? Has any of you read Chateaubriand's memoirs? Okay, so if you've read Chateaubriand's memoirs, I think that that really also solidifies Peter Fricke's arguments. If you haven't read them, I suggest that you do, and you can see how important Fricke is in relation to this, because the memoirs are in themselves quite remarkable. I think what happens in them is the formation of an archetype of a modern exile behind this politically alienated individual. You know, he raises essentially contemporary concerns about the place of home and identity in the modern world. And what's really interesting, I think, and also pertinent for today, is his emphasis on the many selves and his lives laid to rest because of his nomadic lifestyle. And I think in the modern conception of self, I think we have that possibility of making so many different selves, so many different eyes. You know, we have the personality on Facebook, we have the personality around our parents, we have our professional personality. There's so many different ways to explore the ego, to explore the individual. And just because I can, I'll quote to you a section from his preface, which I think really does emphasize, you know, how he really is remarkable in what he says. Okay. If I were destined to survive, I should represent in my person, as depicted in my memoirs, the principles, the ideas, the events, the catastrophes, the epic of my time, all the more so in that I have seen the beginning and the end of a world, and that the opposite characteristics of the end and of that beginning are combined in my opinions. I have found myself between two centuries, as at the junction between two rivers. I have plunged into their troubled waters, regretfully leaving behind the ancient strand where I was born and swimming hopefully towards the unknown shores where the new generations will land. So he really does feel like he's in the midst of a huge historical change. So Fricke and Boehm talk a lot about exile. And in my opinion, I think that in this category of exile, it's really important to include two other terms, which I'll talk a little bit about later, alienation and isolation. And I think those two terms, in terms of the modern sense of self and the writing of the autobiography, are really important. So also important, you know, part and parcel to that modern status, the elusive, the off-modern that Svetlana Boehm talks about in her introduction to the future of nostalgia. Fricke also talks a lot about loss, and I'd like to open this up for discussion later and ask you what you think the role of loss is in the modern or anti-modern or off-modern condition. And think I'd ask you to think about whether or not it's inherent to this modern human condition. Additionally, Fricke is important in the fact that he talks about how nostalgia is connected with skepticism about the present. And I think that's also a really key point that he brings into the picture. And it's an easy way to segue into Svetlana Boehm. Because when I think about skepticism and nostalgia, I actually was in Russia during the summer studying Russian there. And it's very palpable in contemporary Russian society now to have this vague popular sense of nostalgia for communism. And I think that's such an interesting point in light of the fact that we have now Putin and Medvedev, and Russia's role in the world is sort of, they don't know what's going to happen, we don't know what's going to happen. And when you go there, it's interesting to hear people say life was so much easier under communism. They use communism as a branding for selling things. There's a very popular return to the idea of communist days being these golden days and sort of overlooking, obviously, all of the horrors that happened there. I mentioned it was an easy way to segue into Svetlana Boehm because I'm sure, as you noticed, she is from St. Petersburg. And if any of you have been there, it's a very nostalgic city in and of itself. And I think that her interaction with nostalgia is tinged with her own personal life. And one of those, what that brings to the table for me is essentially the question, can you discuss nostalgia without having a personal dimension to it? I mean, is it really possible to separate yourself when discussing nostalgia from, academic discussions? So I actually met Svetlana Boym last week at Harvard, and I feel quite honored to have met her since she has been an intellectual inspiration to me. So I thought that I would share with you, she imparted upon me some nostalgic mementos, and I thought that I would show them to you because they will help you understand a little bit more how she thinks about nostalgia and where she's coming from. She's not only an intellectual, but she's also an artist. So it's a really interesting intersection for her nostalgic work. The first thing is this nostalgic technologies. It's actually a pamphlet that she gave out at one of her art exhibitions. And she's a very playful individual, very funny. And she said to me when she gave this to me, it's actually a book cover. She said, in the modern world, it's no longer necessary to write a whole book. All you need to do is create a book cover. So this is what she passed out. It's her notes for an off-modern manifesto. So off-modern, you read about that term in the work. And basically, she's very fascinated in her artistic work about the error in technology and how that's sort of a unique way to get past sort of the mundane reliability of technological progress, shall we say. So I'll pass that around so you guys can look at it. And then another project that she's working on that's very much involved in nostalgia and is her artistic project called Phantasmagorias, and it's essentially the act of animating the past. So what she's done is she's gone into historical archives in Russia and in the Czech Republic and in the Eastern Bloc and gone into her own personal memoirs. This is her when she's a child by the Black Sea. But she's found photographs, very haunting photographs of public, the public standing up in protest to communism, or if you've studied Gustav Klutsis, you know that in the Soviet Union they cut out pictures of individuals and you have these haunting empty absences of people in photographs, and she's taken them and made them into sort of stop-motion film. So this is just obviously a piece of paper, but when you look at it, she has a website, so you can see the running films online. It's very, very haunting and a very interesting way to sort of approach artistically nostalgia and her personal academic interest in nostalgia. So just take a look at those. So points about Boym, and some of you, well, a lot of you actually, picked up on these on your questions and pointers. A big point about Boym is that her nostalgia that she describes is both temporal and spatial. So it's a longing for a past, it's a past time and a past home. And she emphasizes, and this is where she's much actually more sophisticated than Fichte in her addressing of nostalgia, is that it actually can be and often is a nostalgia for an illusion. So, you know, she says it is a sentiment of loss and displacement, but also a romance with one's own fantasy. So essentially, she's getting at the fact that maybe what we are nostalgic for never actually really existed. She lingers on the idea that nostalgia has this utopian dimension to it. You know, she talks about how nostalgia doesn't need to go forward, it doesn't need to go backward, it can go sideways, and that it feels confined by conventional chronological treatment of space and time. And I think what's interesting about Boym is that she talks more about today. And, you know, she talks about the globalized world, our fascination with cyberspace. What does Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, all of those social networks that we have today, what do those imply about the modern condition and the autobiographical impulse? Because that's really what that is. It's the desire to tell people about yourself. I mean, it's a lot faster than writing a whole autobiography, but it's still there. So I think that's very pertinent in Boym's treatment. And I agree with her also that nostalgia is, by and large, a rebellion against the modern idea of time, the idea that we have to work 40 hours plus, you know, a work week, that we have to be slaves to this sort of time responsibility that we have in place in modern society. Svetlana Boym's nostalgic essentially wants to obliterate history and bring myth of the past into the forefront. And she concludes that the longing of nostalgia is universal, but that the object of the longing is what divides society. And I think that's where her treatment of nostalgia gets really interesting, because her two main theses, all of these points sort of are articulated by her two main tenets of restorative, or her two main tendencies of restorative and reflective nostalgia, which I'm sure you all read about. So restorative nostalgia has two main battle cries, right? So it's the battle cry of return to origins and then conspiracy theory. So like she says, it doesn't believe itself to be a nostalgia. It perceives itself as absolute truth, as to be equal to truth and tradition, and it stresses the return home aspect of nostalgia and is at the core of national and religious revivals. So in my mind, when I think of restorative nostalgia, it's the nostalgia of Nazi Germany, it's the nostalgia of Vichy France, it's also the nostalgia of the Olympics to a certain degree, and the list goes on, really. It's a very interesting way to look at national movements. And then there's the reflective nostalgia aspect, which on the other hand is far less aggressive. I like to call it the nostalgia of limbo. It's a static nostalgia, and it thrives on the act of longing itself. And Svetlana Boym says, it delays the homecoming wistfully, ironically, and does not follow a single plot, but explores ways of inhabiting many places and times at once. So this ambivalence, you know, she talks about, if you have any background in Slavic history or in Slavic literature, you know about Nabokov, you know about Brodsky, you know about these exiled Russian writers and how they developed this survival aesthetics, essentially, of estrangement and longing from their mother country, because they couldn't accept completely the fact that they weren't there anymore, but they knew at the same time that if they had gone back, it wouldn't be the same anymore. And again, I mean, this also is very applicable to the memoirs of Chateaubriand and going back to how he saw his own life. So last year, when I was in Professor Hellman's class, I wrote about largely restorative nostalgia in Russia and Slavophiles. But now what I'm moving into and what I'm more interested in is reflective nostalgia, because I believe it produces an artistic and ethical challenge. And this is where, you know, my own experience of reflective nostalgia and the off-modern that Svetlana Boym talks about is important, because my personal history in nostalgia is as follows. So when I was 7 years old, my parents decided to pick up their relatively normal lives and live out an experiment for 3.5 or so years, which meant moving myself and my two younger sisters, one being just a newborn, into a 150-year-old farmhouse and living the back-to-the-land experience. So as close as they could possibly get reasonably to living in nature. And that meant everything from raising our own chickens. We had an orchard. We had we pickled things. I learned how to drive a horse buggy, literally. And, you know, milk cows. And we cooked on a wood-burning stove. We didn't have a television. We didn't have a VCR. We didn't have an answering machine. I think it was probably, you know, a tough decision for my parents to even think about electricity and a refrigerator, but, you know, they did it for the kids, or maybe, who knows. And then, you know, the cake on top of it all was the fact that they built us this treehouse, right? So not just any treehouse, but like Swiss Family Robinson treehouse. It had 8-foot ceilings. It had built-in bunk beds. It had bookshelves in there. And we just lived outside, I mean, literally. And so I think it was also at a very crucial point in my life, because my two younger sisters were a little bit too young to sort of remember it as clearly as I do. I was 7 to basically 10 years old. And I think it's really crucial in terms of me realizing, you know, however many years down the line, that I was suddenly nostalgic for this period in my life. You know, it represents such a beauteous picture. Maybe not for my parents, who see it a little bit more rationally, you know, winter snowstorms and so on and so forth, the struggles of a really mundane life after 3 years, the economic problems that go along with it. My parents decided after 3 years that they had to, you know, move back into civilization. But of course, I don't think about those things when I think about that. And why I think this is interesting and where I'm moving now with my interest in nostalgia is how nostalgia for childhood, and I don't mean just childhood in terms of my youth or of anyone's youth, I mean nostalgia for that state of lost innocence or the state of paradise, the state of missing spontaneity and intense creativity that we have in childhood of revelation and spiritual vitality, how that affects so many 19th century and 20th century personalities in their creative drive. So how that informs the way that they see the world and the way that they make their art or their literature. So that's where I'm going now with my interest. Since I'm I have a few more minutes left, I'm just going to talk quickly about two individuals who fall into this plane, namely because I understand that you're going to be reading Camus later on. And with Camus' childhood, you'll be reading the First Man. And so it's really, really crucial to think about his time in Algeria as a childhood and how that informs all of his oeuvre. Like, after you read this book, even though it was published after his death, how that really can shed a light on all of his other works. So just briefly, I'll drink water. Just briefly, I wanted to talk about Proust and Chagall, who are two of my favorite artists and intellectuals, and who are extremely, extremely informed by their experience of childhood. And you know, it really lights the way that they created for themselves in terms of making art. So with Proust, I mean, his work is called In Search of Lost Time, so that's clearly quite evident. If you've read any parts of Proust, anyone? So, for Proust, the point is that all paradises are lost paradises. So everything that is real and important in the world to him can only be felt in remembering through what he calls involuntary memory. And for him, the act of eating a Madeleine cake, as you all, it's very famous, you know, brings back to him all of his childhood. So the sensation, the taste of eating this little piece of cake dipped in tea brings him back to childhood, brings him back to his mother's kiss, brings him back to the place where he felt best, essentially. And so, essentially, his conclusion after struggling, and this work is really part memoir, part novel, it's really an artistic rendition of Proust's vision, of his philosophy, is that the only way that he can escape the fact that he can't live in his past is that he has to create a piece of artwork that will be monument to his childhood, essentially. So he writes this 3,000 or whatever so page long book, all in the hope that this piece of artwork will be removed from time and, you know, be placed in that category of timeless artwork. So his memories of childhood and that importance is preserved forever. Unfortunately, I don't have a PowerPoint presentation about Chagall, but I did bring books if you want to look at pictures afterwards. I'm sure all of you are familiar with Marc Chagall, who, you don't need to have seen all of Chagall's paintings to know what his style is. If you put a Chagall painting in front of yourself and you've never seen it before, you would know that it was Chagall if you've seen a few of his paintings. He has a very distinct way of painting, a very distinct language of painting. And I think my understanding of Chagall and the way that I'm looking at it right now is that he was extremely fascinated and touched by his experience of his native city, Vitebsk, which I hope I'm not pronouncing incorrectly. And essentially, he conjured up in his paintings all of these deep, mysterious beliefs and customs that he was exposed to or not exposed to. I mean, really bringing the myth of the Russian Jewish village to the forefront in all of his paintings. And he is an autobiographical painter, whether or not he's painting for the Yiddish theater or making stained glass windows or, making those first really exciting paintings of his youth, essentially. What he's creating is an exotic world of a reconstructed past. And I think Proust does this also in his novel, and they're very similar in the way that they want to create this magical childhood world where revelation and transcendence are the key. Chagall's work is actually rich in symbols of paradise. There's the donkey, which is the animal of Christ. you know, there's the engaged couple that float above his villages, and essentially he's creating the sacred world of childhood in his paintings, regardless of the themes that he, other themes that he is, he's touching, and also regardless of the fact that he is a modernist painter. So he's on that cusp, that Baudelaire talks about, on, you know, about being in the contingent as well as in the eternal. So he takes all different types of artistic tendencies, from whether or not it's the symbolists, the Malevich, the cubofuturists, and he's still keeping his idea of representation and fusing those forms to really create a lost world. So in conclusion, I invite you to essentially open up the floor for discussion. I'd be happy to hear any questions, concerns, ideas, nostalgic stories that you have to share. And I hope you enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much, Maya. Our norms here in these History and Memory sessions, as you know, we usually have a discussion for, say, 30 to 45 minutes afterwards, and then we adjourn and continue informally but off camera. Right? So thank you so much, and we'll just open the floor to any questions that somebody has.
I know you have some. I saw the questions and pointers.
I just interested. You said one of your interests was sort of kind of artistic purity and authenticity. And Boyan raised the question when she was collecting the restoration of the Sistine Chapel. She asked the question, which version is more authentic?
Yeah.
This version which has been restored, or this original painting of Michelangelo's, which was, she used the phrase, left accident of time. And that was kind of like a neat turn of phrase. So where do you weigh in, or where does that process of restoration sort of fit?
I mean, you put me in between a rock and a hard place. I mean, that's clearly a really, really difficult question to answer. I mean, what is more authentic? Are you going to leave it to decay and then have it be, you know, removed from human consciousness so that, you know, millennia down the line, no one knows of the Sistine Chapel? Or are you going to restore it and essentially ruin the process of time? You know, honestly, I don't know where I personally stand on that. If you want to look at it theoretically, practically, I would say restore it, because if you think about it in Proust's terms, art, and you want to remove it from the decay of time, I would hope that, you know, people in the future would know about the Sistine Chapel and be able to experience its glory, definitely. Does anyone else have any contrary opinions about restoration or any ideas like that? Yes.
I guess I saw restoration as something that's so, like, it tries to be so definite in the number of opinions that you could really hold of something. Like for the Sistine Chapel, you know, the cracks and everything that she was saying, you really get a sense of, like, and this thing has moved and has seen many faces, and, you know, has had, God knows, like, you know, Mussolini looking up at, you know. And I think that it's an important element. I'm against restoration in a sense, because you can open up so much more, like more historical depth, I guess, to opinions and things. You could actually, like, have. I think it's better for the historic field in a sense that. You don't have a straight hard line.
Yeah. It's really interesting, actually, that you bring that up. When I was in Russia this summer, I visited the town of Pushkin, which is where all of the summer palaces of the Tsars and the Tsarinas were. And during World War II, the Germans were able to capture Pushkin. They came that close to home, essentially. And what they did, the Russians, is that they restored some of the palaces, but they left the other ones that were in complete ruin and decay. And when I went to go visit it, it was all the more haunting, actually, to see the restored versions, which weren't actually completely restored at that time. They were still waiting for the money to come in to go all the way. The intention was to restore them. But to see those restored in absolute splendor, I mean, like nothing I've ever seen before, and next to them sort of the bombed out remains of another Tsar's palace. And to see them next to each other, you get this feeling of the presence of history, and really that, yes, this place has been going through a whole story of rise and decline, essentially. And that was really interesting. And I think that they did the right thing there to leave some of those in ruin just for historical memory.
I also think it's interesting. I haven't read the Boehm article, but I think it's interesting to look at, I guess, the dangers of restorations, in that if you're harking back to an old history, you kind of have to construct that history first to go back to it. So, and I'm not sure as much with buildings, but I know, like with the dangers of the conservation movement, for instance, where you're trying to build national parks and stuff to reclaim this wilderness, first you have to invent a wilderness, which doesn't have Native Americans and doesn't have poor white farmers in it, and then you can kind of capture it. So I wonder what kind of risks we run with nostalgic preservation of buildings, too, you know, in terms of declaring that this piece of history that we've created ourselves is the specific point in this eternal timeline that we want to preserve.
Well, I mean, just thinking of, for instance, the history of France, it's so important, memory places, in the construction of French national identity and preserving, you know, memories of World War I. It's like the huge thing, right? So it's all part and parcel of that. Which memories do we keep? Which memories do we not keep? In Moscow, they have a special garden to all of the statues of communism. It's just this... it's almost comic when you go there and you see Brezhnev and you see Stalin and you see Lenin and you see the peasant, and it's just, okay, so they've just sort of gathered them all together, put them in this little garden, and just falling to ruins there with you know, long uncut grass, until a modern artist decided, well, this is great. Let's start a modern outdoor sculpture garden here too. So alongside with, you know, these very serious historical criminals, you have modern art at the same time. So commemorating the past and bringing in new things, I mean, there's always going to be fine lines. What would you have done with those monuments? Yes?
Right, and I noticed something just last week, actually, or when was during the closing ceremonies of the Olympics. I don't know if anybody else caught that, but it seems that in the collapse of the Soviet Union, kind of left this sort of restoration, right? And there was sort of the some reflective nostalgia, right? And like some sort of negative moment in which nobody to rebuild anything. So, you know, everybody's left their open interpretations and such. But just last week, there was socialist realism.
Oh, yes.
Put forward,
yes.
With the Sochi 2014
yes.
games. I mean, visually, with the great, like you mentioned, the peasant.
Yes,
the
I was in absolute shock when I saw that. I was watching the closing ceremony. My two roommates are Bulgarian and Ukrainian, and, you know, with my Slavic history background, we were all up in arms. You know, what is the socialist realism? Why is there, you know, sort of this virtual reality peasant man and peasant woman, like, soaring through virtual reality, Sochi? You know, it was really, really interesting. And I thought that the closing ceremony of the Olympics was supposed to be the closing ceremony of the Olympics, not, you know, welcome to Russia. And that clearly was, you know, welcome to the new and powerful Russia, but at the same time, that new and powerful Russia, the national anthem, it's the same communist music. And all of this coming together, I thought that was a very interesting point. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think maybe that there's like a hidden in this case, I see it. It's, you know, predicting, of course, so I don't know for sure, but that this socialist realism imagery and this return to communism is some sort of attempt by, and I'm joining two things here, because the President Medvedev has just sacked the president of the Russian Olympic Committee for the, you know, the bad performance and such. So if the Russian government has such a big leverage over something like that, I see this attempt, 2014, as to present, here is the future of Russia. It's a politicized thing.
Oh, it's absolutely a politicized thing. In so many ways. I mean, China was a politicized thing, too. The Olympics, when you host the Olympics, it inherently, unfortunately, becomes political. I don't think you can escape that, especially now. But when it's done by, you know, a country like Russia, or even a country like China, economic power and so on and so forth, I think it means so much more in in the eyes of the world. And I think it means so much more to them also. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they do in terms of preparing for Sochi, in terms of whether or not it's training athletes or what kind of outlandish buildings they're going to make, and where that money is going to come from, and how it's going to actually be spent, whether or not it's going to, you know, sift through the sieve and you know, end up somewhere else, or if it's really going to go somewhere. That's a really interesting point.
I had a question on it.
Oh, go ahead.
And it was regarding free space reading. And you mentioned it as well, that the role of the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolution and individuals like Chateaubriand, very much like influential roles in nostalgia and how it came to be. I was wondering, when I grew up, I had the chance to be in the French system, and we spent a whole semester on just romanticism. And I was wondering, with the themes that are very definitive of the romantic sort of movement, such as the Middle Ages that were completely ignored, the Jeux, and sort of in the theater world, they kind of eliminated the rules that were there before. I was wondering, to what extent did romanticism as a movement have an effect on nostalgia?
Well, I think romanticism and nostalgia were really hand in hand, at least in the modern historical, the modern history version of nostalgia. I think you can't actually separate them. I mean, if you look at so many romantic artists, so many romantic poets, nostalgia plays so much of a part of that, whether it's Tennyson or whether it's Wordsworth or whether it's looking at, there was just a Waterhouse exhibition at Musée des Beaux-Arts, and I went to visit it, and I was just really taken by how much nostalgia was involved in his painting. It was really, really touching. And I mean, even the women and the children were so almost Greek in their portrayal, and you know, the delicate influence of nostalgia for childhood, which was also very present. So I think that you're very right in saying that nostalgia and romanticism do go hand in hand, especially after the French Revolution. Yes?
You seem to be really interested about nostalgia and childhood as well as Lost Paradise. I don't know if you've ever read the memoirs of Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
Yes,
but you would find, very interesting about how he's probably one of the first to see childhood
as
Lost Paradise.
He is one of the first to really talk about his childhood as being an important aspect of, I mean, so many people for so long didn't touch childhood. Childhood was, you know, stay quiet, sit, not an important part of human development.
Probably also because memoirs in 18th century France, it was always, more or less 17th century, is where the public life that was important.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, I just thought I wasn't sure you read it.
No, absolutely.
You kind of addressed it earlier about the periodization that these two authors kind of they kind of use, and Philip just brought up how in the Romantic period they kind of ignored the medieval period to sink into, and as myself, I'm kind of nerd of the modernists, and I find it surprising that a lot of the notions that they talk about here, they ignore sources or they just completely manipulate the actual facts to the point where they're unrecognizable to original to the original periods. And things like that struck me when you talk about the spatialization of time. Like, within the medieval period, for example, you have this tradition of map making, where in traveling eastwards, you travel geography, but you also travel
back
in time.
Absolutely. No, I touched. I did a lot on that actually when I was studying Russia last year, because that's exactly how they perceived it. Essentially, moving east was moving back into barbarity, and that's a really it's a really interesting notion. I don't know a lot about the medieval period. I didn't study it, but for sure that plays a key role. And I think you're right in saying that it's not all of these things aren't only in the modern period. I think that, you know, Boehm does talk about, for instance, Odysseus and this mystical return home. I don't think that nostalgia suddenly appeared after the French Revolution. I don't think it suddenly appeared when the doctor, you know, said, this is nostalgia. I just think that there's something to be said about how widespread the French Revolution was and how cataclysmic it was on the European psyche as a whole. That's the key about him. And how it does make nostalgia into a historical emotion. Not that nostalgia hadn't been felt by individuals or groups before that.
Would you think that the increase in nostalgia was a result of the event of the French Revolution, or do you think that the French Revolution was a period in which it gave people the chance to reflect on their past? Because what I'm saying is the French Revolution itself, and people get it from a very kind of aesthetic perspective, like all the things that occur are not the first time they occur. Like, they have all those types of things, like the revolution, you know, the killing of the king, like, they've all occurred before, but what's unique is the reflection on it.
I think what it comes down to is just the number of people and that the fact that all classes of society were affected by that. I mean, in England, they killed the king in what was 1640s. But I don't think that it had as huge of an impact on all of society. And you're right in saying that, yes, it forced them to reflect. But I think it's because so many people could write about their personal experience and have someone else across, you know, the nation understand what they were saying that makes it important.
Would you give credit to the fact that more people can write about it is a reflection of the society and the environment itself and the increase in education of the growing middle class, not necessarily the increase of the notion of nostalgia within the general people? The fact that more people were writing about these things or
yes.
more reflections, mm-hmm. to me, it's more a result of, you know, increased education, more people literate, increased, you know, the ability for parents and things like that, instead of, you know, a change in epistemic
foundation. For sure, it has to do with society and the means of expressing oneself. But I don't think that you can ignore the fact, for instance, that after the French Revolution and after World War II were like the biggest times for autobiographical reflection and for preserving, you know, memoirs and so on and so forth. But point well taken, absolutely. Yes?
At least last semester we talked a lot about nostalgia kind of being linked to this very Western
mm-hmm.
sense of selfhood.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if you put that at all or if there's anything about like nostalgia in kind of post-colonial societies or like Creole societies?
I personally don't know a lot about nostalgia and post-colonialism per se and specific societies, but if you want to talk about outside of the Western tradition, I'm a fan of Chinese poetry, and nostalgia figures very greatly in Chinese poetry that goes back millennia. It's very interesting to read poems that you would think that are so free of form and are so right on the nostalgic tack, if you want to say, that, for instance, poets in the Western tradition don't start writing in that way until, you know, after the 20th century, essentially. But definitely for post-colonial images, I would recommend reading Roland Barthes. He's important in semiotics and looking at imagery, and but there's a lot of literature out there about that for sure. Yes.
I'm thinking specifically of a painting that I bought, who portrayed, I think, the Greek Revolution.
Yes.
And I was wondering, is it common for in the past, more I say in the 19th century or early 20th century, is it common for individuals to portray nostalgia of, I guess, for identities that they don't really share themselves? Is it something that happens a lot? And is this also something that, I mean, do people feel nostalgic for something that they haven't, that really doesn't, I guess, affect them in a certain way, or it doesn't go hand in hand with their history or their identity?
Well, I think when Boehm talks about nostalgia for an illusion, I think that's really important. Longing for something that not necessarily was your own or is part of your own history. I think I'm trying to think of an example offhand. I'm doing some work now on art theory and abstraction and how, for instance, certain abstract artists are going for the same ideals as the classical idea of beauty. So I don't know if that answers your question at all, but I think that moving outside of your own experience with nostalgia does happen, but I think it's more likely that you have a personal attachment to some aspect of that longing.
On that point, if I could just...
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned Proust before, and that interesting quotation where Proust said, you know, nostalgia is always for lost paradises. All paradises are lost paradises. And I can recall how Proust was ignored for years after his death, during his life and after his death. And then the 50s and 60s, when Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir were the paramount intellectual couple in the world, an interest in Proust began to arise. Mm-hmm. And Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir weighed in violently against Proust because they were, you know, fellow travelers of the French Communist Party, and for them, you know, they argued this is the archetype of bourgeois self-indulgence. Mm-hmm. Sit around and write thousands of pages about your beautiful lost paradise of childhood. And so the question I really want to ask you is, to what extent is nostalgia, the experience of nostalgia, this actually came into your presentation from the beginning, tied up essentially with a beautiful experience of childhood in individuals or in societies? Like, could one say, for example, that in a society that had lived very grim and ugly lives for generations, you wouldn't find any students of nostalgia or people particularly interested in nostalgia, but in people who are lucky enough, fortunate enough, or from a Marxist point of view, prosperous enough to remember their childhood and their past with nostalgia, well, there you're going to find an interest in nostalgia. But from a Marxist point of view, again, you couldn't say it was a universal human experience. It's something that's a bourgeois self-indulgence in a way. I mean, essential to it is having a happy childhood. And how many people have a happy childhood? And most of the people here in this room probably did, but we're a privileged minority, aren't we? I mean, here in this university and in the city and the backgrounds we have.
I think it gets complicated when you think about communism, which is why the Russian thing right now is so interesting in terms of looking back and seeing communism as being this happy place. And in terms of looking at nostalgia as being bourgeois and it being a middle-class phenomenon, to a certain degree, it is correct that you have to have a certain temperament, I guess you would have to say, to feel this sort of longing for some sort of... Because what that is really is spiritual revelation. I would argue that, what happens is that your longing for childhood, at least for Proust and my understanding of Proust, is this desire to have an authentic experience and an authentic transcendent experience, which is why he's always going on about involuntary memory and how it can only happen by chance. He's not in control of it. And that's where this sort of fate transcendence thing enters into the equation. With communism and Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre, it gets complicated because it's arguable that though not portraying themselves in such a nostalgic way, childhood had a huge role in Simone de Beauvoir. I mean, not in the same Proustian sense, but in terms of lighting a beacon for her to move forward with her work and her ideas, her childhood experience had a profound effect on her. Communism, at least in Russia and at least, you know, my study of it, it gets complicated because in Russia, what they believed was that communism would bring back this ancient, ancient Russian democracy. It would bring back an ancient tradition that had existed far before, you know, essentially the nation state was even created. So I don't know if I'm running around in circles here trying to answer too many things at the same time, but I think that it's a delicate... it's a delicate balance, and that's why I think Boehm is important, because the reflective aspect of it is bourgeois to a certain degree, but the restorative tendency is very much grounded in real practical life, whether or not it is for, you know, fascists, communists, or any type of political rally. They have an attachment to some type of an identity. Does that make sense? I mean, for instance, the French Communist Party has its heroes of the past that I'm sure it looks back to, you know?
And memory places.
And memory places to commemorate those. Yeah. Exactly. So...
I don't want to jump in front of other people, but I wanted to ask a question I've been wanting to ask from the beginning. I noticed in a lot of students, when they begin studying memory and autobiography and sort of things, students often say, not expand on it a great deal, but they say, I'm beginning to look at things the way I lead my life differently, because since I've got interested in memory. And And I want to ask you, having been in a sustained reflection about nostalgia now for a few years, if you study this and think about memory, I mean, what effect does it have on the way you live your life? In other words, do you begin to look at your life as, say, a collection of or a series of spots of time that are important to preserve? Or do you, since you had this experience of childhood, you can say, whatever happens to me in life, I really want to have, provide for my children, for example, something like the experience I had as a child in Vancouver Island. In other words, does it really affect your life project in a way in your priorities? And if so...
I would have to say yes, it does affect my life priorities. I mean, I still have a laptop, I still own a MacBook, so, you know, certain aspects of it don't change. In terms of how I remember Prince Edward Island, my family does the nomadic trip back there every year. It's like this, you know, coming into being trip. Every year we have to go back, it's like the same time of year, and I would love to give my kids, you know, a similar experience, because it has been so formative, and I look at it as being so important in my personal life. And I think Boehm says, you know, nostalgia is a rebellion against the modern sense of time, and I think that's part of the reason actually why I want to go into academics. I think that's part of the reason why I want to have control over my time. I don't want to, you know, work the 9 to 5. And so in that respect, I think that studying nostalgia and thinking about nostalgia has influenced the way I see my life progressing and the choices that I make. Yes. Anyone else feel nostalgic?
I have something that I see this whole idea of reflective and distorted nostalgia as one step leading to the other. And because I study mostly modern history, mm-hmm. so, and I'm very interested in totalitarianism.
Yes.
And I'm seeing, I was studying the Polish case of right after fascism arose, mm-hmm. another form of totalitarianism. And there's like a brief sort of window where it was reflective through people's sort of nostalgia for what happened, like the Nazi crimes and what happened. And then after a while, like the state kind of moved in and just kind of squashed that to become restorative again. But I almost see that reflective nostalgia is almost like for, and maybe I'm wrong, but maybe it's like exclusive to intellectuals and intellectual life. While restorative nostalgia is for like everybody else who's not really stimulated by thought, they just want answers.
That's a very interesting point. It's a very interesting thing to. It's a very interesting way to think about both of them. And I don't necessarily see reflective leading up to restorative and vice versa, but you're very right in saying that totalitarianism manipulates nostalgia. And Boehm talks about how dangerous it is because, you know, the pursuit of the ideal and creating the ideal home is at the core of so many, you know, ideologies. So the perfect example, of course, is either Germany or Vichy France, but, you know, you have bread, family, and, you know, work as being your motto, and that essentially is bringing France back to its ancient identity prior to all of the Republican mess and so on and so forth. So what happens is you're very right, is that's a populist form. Restorative nostalgia often is populist. Not in all examples, but often, because it's feeding essentially people who are hungry for answers, people who are displaced, people who don't understand what's happening to them and which way does the world work now. It gives them an easy formulaic answer. That's not always the case because you have, in Russia, for instance, I keep going back to this example, but it's what I'm most familiar with, the Slavophiles, who start off as really being... they're never really restorative because they can't get their act together, essentially. And they start out as, they are a group of intellectuals, and essentially that's why they fail in their project. So, I mean, there's examples that support both sides, but I would say, by and large, you are correct in saying that it is, it's a populist sentiment forced from above downwards, restorative nostalgia. And in totalitarianism, it's huge. I mean, everything from, like, literally the political acts that they make to, for instance, in Germany, the body politic, just the art of the body, for instance, in Germany is very, going back, very nostalgic as well. Yes?
Where do you see it, I
especially, I guess, in this age where we seem to be constantly in this, you know, absorbed in this declension thesis and always talking about the U.S. and Canada, and maybe Canada by extension, of being on the decline. You know, you have the Tea Party movements in the U.S. harkening back and moving further and further away from the golden age of American capitalism and democracy. And I guess even creating this thought today in terms of, I'm sure even by 2002, people were talking about a post 9/11 world and being fully aware of being in a post-break, you know, world.
Well, I mean, I think that's really the interesting part of, I think, modern consciousness and modern autobiographical impulse is this understanding of I in history. And I think that's what makes it interesting, is the fact that not all of a sudden, but there really is this palpable understanding of me, I'm in history, and I'm not necessarily a force as an individual, but I have a place in this giant scheme of things. As far as, I mean, the decline of America, you could go on forever about the decline of America, but it depends on who you talk to. I mean, if you go down to the U.S., I don't think they necessarily see themselves. If you go down into the South and where, I don't want to name any names, actually. But it's hard. It depends on the perspective. And there is, I think, a lot of feeling that, you know, the U.S. is moving towards this age of decline. Yes, it's the end of the American capitalist world. But at the same time, I don't know. I don't know where I could go with that. There's so many different directions. Are you on the cusp of saying something?
Do you think that you were talking before about, you know, social networks and that sort of stuff? You know, we live in a world where everything is recorded, right? Like everything is captured, right? Like much more so than any other time period in history. And so, do you think maybe that sort of given how easy it is to capture everything these days, do you think that's almost going to make it impossible for people to be nostalgic about this period in time? Because it's like we're almost not giving ourselves enough distance between like the present and the past, because we have, you know, I have like 500 pictures of myself documenting, like, you know, the time period between who am I now and like last Tuesday, right? Like it's impossible to be nostalgic about that distance of time, right? Like there is no distance in that realm.
I think the social networking aspect and always taking pictures and always recording, I think it's really interesting. I think it's indicative of a certain yearning for community, and I would say that that's also part and parcel to sort of a revival in religious movements today that we're seeing, is sort of not feeling together and needing to form groups. In terms of whether or not we're going to feel nostalgic, I think you will feel nostalgic. I think, you know, you may not feel nostalgic for next Tuesday, but wait until you graduate. I also think that what the constant recording means is also it's just a solidification of the fact that we don't live in the present. Is that, I mean, I remember being at Sacré-Cœur in Paris, and I didn't have a camera with me, and I was just standing there and enjoying the view, and I saw this family, and they were camcording everything. There's everything. I mean, making crazy faces and so on and so forth. And I was, you know, looking at them and saying, these people, they're going to not actually experience looking over Paris from Sacré-Cœur. They're going to go home and put it in their VCR and say, wasn't that great? But they actually weren't there saying that was great. They were recording it. I mean, I think it's very fascinating what people are, you know, doing in terms of preserving their memories. And that's why I think when Fichte talks about this intensity and desire to preserve everything, I think it's really exacerbated today. I think everything has to be, you know, backed up. Got to back it up, you know? Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Is it because we're scared of losing something? I mean, you talked about how nostalgia, the feeling of nostalgia really came about after the French Revolution because of that whole destruction of people's lives. Do you think that it's they started keeping stuff because they were scared it was going to happen again?
I think that the fear of loss, I think nostalgia and fear go really really hand in hand, and fear of losing things, I think, is definitely part of it. And also, I mean, Mookie was talking about the post 9/11 world. I think what we love to do now is like it's post colonialism, it's post 9/11, it's post this, it's post this, it's post 2012 apocalypse year, you know. And there's always these always these tendencies to say, okay, well, my life might be different. And I think that's an inherent paradox of globalism, is essentially that the world is now one giant community, and yet we don't really feel that way because we have this incessant network, you know, necessity to update our status on Facebook, like everyone needs to know how I'm feeling right now type thing. And I think that's a really interesting thing to look at in terms of, you know, sociologists now is where does this impulse come from, and what is society saying when this is necessary? And also, I think, again, like I just said a few seconds ago, is the rise of religion and essentially decline of secularism, which is huge. I think that's a really big thing to think about now and intersect that with nostalgia studies.
I have a question of causality. What about, what's your attitude toward the evolution of attitudes toward the dead? Because if you walk through a cemetery, like you walk through Mount Royal Cemetery, you'll find, you know, the older gravestones don't have nostalgia, because people believed in eternal life. People believed that people died, and they went to heaven or hell. And then you get into the 19th century, and also, I mean, Montreal is so shaped by the nostalgia of Mount Royal Cemetery. I mean, here are these wealthy Montrealers in the 19th century who decide they needed an adequate and beautiful place
to bury their dead.
To bury their dead and to go up and remember their dead in a beautiful setting. But that Frederick Olmsted had already done in Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Mass. And so here we have dominating the city what was really a beautiful cemetery to recall the dead. And when you look at this, the gravestones, so many of them are profoundly nostalgic. And so can you say, I think Philip Barrias does say this, that, you know, this discovery, if you will, of nostalgia for the dead is something that's relatively recent, that emerges, you know, with some of the sources you talk about, with Rousseau, for example. And in the 19th century, with Chateaubriand, he really, and you said this yourself, really expresses a sense of loss regarding his dead, like he doesn't have any, show any sign of confidence he's going to join them again after death. And so I'm just wondering if this is perhaps one route of reflection toward arriving at an explanation for what you're describing. If society as a whole believed for a long time that they would see their dead again, their loved ones again in another world, that's one thing. But if suddenly society as a whole sort of suspects, if it doesn't declare openly, they won't see their dead again, then perhaps this really triggers a massive experience of nostalgia, a sense of loss regarding your loved ones.
Well, I think that I think you're right. I think it is really important when looking at nostalgia to look at secularization, at least, I mean, in terms of the 19th century and well, I mean, before the 19th century as well, but just looking at how, like you said, not being able to see your dead again really was foundational in feeling that you were really losing something. And that's why I think now it's interesting to see religious revival, because I think that society, by and large, feels like there's a longing for community. I think there's that lack of togetherness, and I think that's why that there is this sort of global polarization, if you will, I mean, it's causing obviously a lot of friction, but I think that's part and parcel to why there's such a need for, you know, revival of religion in the United States, which has been secular for so long, really.
But is religion essential to contact with the dead? Or to rejoining the dead, or preserving one's liaison with the dead?
I would think yes. I mean, I think it's a clearly a religious, spiritual connection that you would believe that you would be able to connect with them in the afterlife.
That's an interesting line of reflection.
It's not religious, spiritual,
yeah.
Like it's, I mean, if you're an atheist and you believe that we are animals, and we're on, you know, just animals on earth, and then you die and you, I mean, we're flesh and blood, there's no, you can't, and you don't have a spirit that kind of lives on afterwards, you can't connect to it.
Yeah, but you can. Remember when Leah did that remarkable presentation on Joseph Cornell, you can create memory boxes. You can you can, you mentioned this right at the beginning, like you said your family did that in a way, and you keep all these objects that are related to a dead person that don't mean anything to anybody except the person who loved this person, and you preserve them jealously. You don't have to be a spiritual person or a
living
person to do that. You can keep a memory place, or you can keep objects that are associated with a loved one, and it can perdure, allow the bond to perdure, you know?
I think there is some necessary spiritual aspect to that. I mean, sometimes I kind of find it weird that we have this farmhouse with all this stuff in there. And it's hard because if your parents don't pass on those stories to you, it's right. You walk in and you're like, what is this? I mean, what is this little thing? I mean, why is it important to me? Why is it important to my life? But when you hear about, you know, Aunt Evelyn that received it for her 15th birthday and blah, 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 of course, all of that sort of back history becomes important. But I think that there is a spiritual aspect to that, that you have to have some sort of emotional, spiritual desire to connect that line and to keep family tradition going and feel that that's necessary for your future. There's that the need to have those things. It's important for who I'm going to be tomorrow and the day after and for my children. You have to feel like that past going, that moving forward is important.
But this could be experienced on a national scale, isn't it? I mean, you live in Hyde Park. I mean, I'm certain that there must still be black people coming up from the South saying, I want to see where Franklin Delano Roosevelt lived, because they named their children Roosevelt. They named their children Roosevelt. I mean, Roosevelt was almost, you know, I don't know what you'd call him, but for a lot of poor people in the United States who lived through the Depression, he was fairly, somewhat terribly important, and his home, it must be a shrine. It must be a visiting shrine.
Can you see
that shrine?
Yeah, point taken. No, I mean, I understand.
Does anybody have anything else they'd like to ask? Your time is running out here. Okay, well, we've used up our time. I'd like to thank Maya so much for that presentation, which was marvelous on many levels, academic and personal, and she has a nostalgia for her experience here. We have a nostalgia for Maya. On that note, thank you so much.